So I've been thinking a lot about the podcasts I listen to. One in particular stands out. It's called The Bat Segundo Show, and it's a podcast run by Edward Champion, some highly excitable writer in New York who never seems to sleep and always has a lot of free time on his hands. Anyway, the show begins with a strange introduction which features a character named Bat Segundo or some other creation from Champion's mind talking about some part of his life. The intros are funny, but some of them aren't. Most of them aren't, as a matter of fact. But from here, the podcast shifts into a comprehensive interview with Champion, taking on the role of our young roving correspondent. He interviews an author and often closes with some piece of music that either relates to the conversation or features some word in the lyrics that pertains to the book's title or the name of the author himself. Okay, so I am here with Paul Auster, who is the author of the New York Trilogy, Oracle Knight, The Book of Illusions, many other books, and most recently the author of Man in the Dark. Paul, how are you doing today?
Not too bad, thank you.
First off, I wanted to start off with a fairly obvious question. I know that you have stated in various interviews that you often start off with a title for each book that you write, but I have found in your earlier books that titles crop up later. For example, in The Book of Illusions, you make reference to Travels in the Scriptorium. And of course, there is The Inner Life of Martin Faust that is referenced to Faust.
Frost.
And I have to ask you, do you have titles in reserve for books? Is it like a list sort of like what Richard Yates had?
No, it's not quite that. I thought of that title, Travels in the Scriptorium, for The Book of Illusions as a work within it. Mm-hmm. And then I realized I really liked the title, and I decided to use it for a book that I wrote later.
Yeah.
But I wasn't planning to write that book at the moment I invented the title.
I'm curious if any of the titles change over the course of time as you're writing, or are they relatively fixed? You need that momentum going from a title?
Happened to me only once with The Music of Chance. I had a working title, and I was always a little uncomfortable with it. I just wasn't quite satisfied. There's a reference to a piece, a keyboard piece by Couperin in the book, The Mysterious Barricades, which is a beautiful piece of music. And that was my working title, The Mysterious Barricades. But I thought it was too heavy. And one day I was in the supermarket having shopped and was waiting online, and there was all this piped in music coming.
Yeah.
And I just heard the phrase, The Music of Chance, and I said, there's my title.
Fair enough. Well, speaking of this idea of all of your books being this cohesive effort, certainly with the last one, Travels in the Scriptorium, I did catch a brief reference to Mr. Blank in this book, and I'm wondering if that was inserted in the case of having Travels in the Scriptorium being sort of the great prism with which to read all Paul Auster books, just
out of a sense of
completion.
But I feel that there's a definite link between these last two books. Mm-hmm. They treat of different materials. I mean, the stories obviously are not at all similar, but certain situations are the same. You have in both cases an older man in a room. One book takes place during a day, the other takes place during a night.
Yes.
So it seemed to me that one book answers the other. They're a diptych, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
Two separate things, but somehow resonant. And they're both short novels. They're not lengthy tomes. And so I wanted to slip Mr. Blank in there.
Yeah.
To make the link between the two books.
Do you find that the shorter books, they definitely tend to be more baroque and abstract than the longer books, which are more naturalistic, which also leads me into a question about when you use quotes for dialogue and when you don't. You often do. I know that in The Brooklyn Follies you do, as well as Oracle Knight. But if you look at the other books, like, say, The Last Seven, they are no quotes, not even any M dashes or anything
right.
like that. Is there a particular decision on a set of
you're
rules?
You're doing your homework. I'm very glad to answer this question. The first time I did that was as early as Ghosts, which is my second novel, the second book of the New York Trilogy. And I think that not using quotation marks for speech or dialogue somehow for me represents the inwardness of the narration.
Yeah.
And it's coming out of the narrator's head, so we're not actually in some objective third-person world.
Yeah.
And But a book like The Brooklyn Follies, which is more external book with many different characters, it seemed appropriate to go back to using quotation marks.
Yeah.
It's a sense of feel more than anything else.
Huh. I'm wondering if you fight the temptation to constantly look inward in your books. I mean, certainly, inevitably, we see in a Paul Auster book that infamous relationship of a text within a text versus reality, which is, in fact, fictive reality. And I'm wondering if Brooklyn Follies was an effort to kind of combat that, or is it just a matter of where the narrative leads you? Did you plan these books at all, or do you ride on impulse just as you do with the title?
Well, The Brooklyn Follies had a strange history. It was a book that I started thinking about and planning for way back in the early 90s. The idea of writing a comedy,
yeah,
with many different intersecting characters. In that original plan, my original plan, it was going to be a third-person book. And Willie Gurevich, Willie G. Christmas, and Mr. Bones were going to be characters in this large novel. It was to begin with them. And I started the chapter with Willie and Mr. Bones in Baltimore. And I realized I was falling in love with these characters. I decided that I wanted to make a short lyrical novel about them. So I broke them out of the bigger book, and then the structure of the big book collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what to do. And years went by before I figured out a solution. And by that time, the world had changed quite drastically. So a lot of new material came in. But it was something I've been thinking about for a long time.
Huh. Well, the ending of The Brooklyn Follies and the ending of this book share certain similarities in relation to political events. I mean, there's the old axiom that you should never write a book that is didactic or political in some sense. And yet, inevitably, there is this tension between the very real events that are in our world versus this escape into your novel. And I wanted to ask whether you have had these particular endings. I don't want to reveal the ending of Man in the Dark as a way of finding a way to respond through fiction to certain emotions you might have about current events.
So yes, what's the situation? Well, this is a particularly personal book. Well, they're all personal, but this one has a special tone, I think. I think there are two main sources of inspiration. Number one is the 2000 election debacle.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how outraged and frustrated I was by what happened. Gore won the election. He was elected president. And then the Republicans, by political and legal maneuvering, stole it.
Yeah.
And to my great horror, America just sat back and let it happen. So I've been living for these past 7.5 years, going almost 8 now, with the eerie sensation that we're living in a parallel world, that we're no longer in reality. That reality is that Al Gore is coming to the end of his second term. There's no war in Iraq. There might not have been 9/11. And a host of other things that Bush has inflicted on us, and it's going to take so many years to undo. So that was one burning thought in my head as I started the book. The other was the horrendous death of one of my best friend's sons in the Israeli army, David Grossman.
Yeah, who you dedicated the book to.
Yeah, it's dedicated to him and his family and in memory of his son, Yuri, who was just 20 years old, and he was killed in, I think, 1 or 2 days before the ceasefire in 2006, when Israel was fighting Lebanon. His father, who's a great man and a great writer, was agitating for peace, begging Olmert to declare a ceasefire. Just as he's going to see the prime minister, his son is killed.
Yeah.
It was horrifying. And I love David a lot, and this news, it was so shattering to me that I had to do something with it.
I mean, but I'm wondering, though, going back to this question of whether a novel should be didactic, I mean, you kind of face a peril here of being almost overtly political. And in the end of both of those books, Brooklyn and this one, you have the sense that we are, of course, living in the weird world around us, that inevitably, despite the fact that we cannot necessarily do anything about this, there is still this comfort of life, just as I suppose that with a book, when one escapes from life, there is, of course, this comfort of a book. So I want, do you find yourself in this, I suppose, imbroglio to something.
Well, I don't think so. Because I don't think of it as didactic at all. I mean, I'm not preaching anything. I'm simply telling a story.
Yeah.
And if certain elements of our contemporary political life enter into that story, so much the better. I mean, it just doesn't, it's not an issue for me.
Well, this also falls into line with the austere eye-popping moment that I see throughout all of your books, in which we're alluding to this, and I don't want to necessarily give it away in this book, but there is often, within this calm and meditative valley of text, we get settled into this, and then all of a sudden, there's some extraordinary thing happens, like the party scene, the moment in the Book of Illusions, or some incredible act of violence.
The party scene
Leviathan. with the woman and the spilled beverage,
yes.
and the outburst.
That scene. Yeah. Yes.
I mean,
okay.
But that is what I call, I suppose, the Oster fucked up moment, yeah. where all of a sudden, we're not so happy and rosy here. And I wanted to ask you about this, because I find this in almost every one of your books. Is this a way to remind the reader that they are, in fact, reading a book, that as they enter into this relationship with the text, they get kind of cozy, they get kind of lost, and then all of a sudden there's something so deeply unsettling that reminds us that what we are reading is a book.
Well,
is this why you have...
Yeah, there are two questions. First, I want to respond to that scene in the Book of Illusions. Zimmer, the narrator, is a man in total distress.
Yeah.
And we know that very well. And he's shut himself up in a room for almost a year to write a book. He's traveled around to film archives, living alone in hotels. He doesn't see anybody. And he's lured out to this party, and of course he misbehaves. But
yes.
I don't think it's something shocking. It's the absolute culmination of everything he's been living through for the last period of his life. So I never imagined that as a shocking scene.
Well, it's a shocking scene because of the effect it has on this other professor who's sitting there, and that he is unable to see her clear emotional distress during that particular moment.
Yes.
Therefore, it stands out more so, and then we really know that the guy is troubled. I mean, it seems to me that what happens is you have a character often who has a past, who has some deep trauma that he is trying to overcome. And then, as if to affirm the trauma, you have then what I am calling the fucked up Oster moment to confirm
it. I just don't look at it that way. But anyway, to talk about the awareness that one is holding a book in one's hands, yes, of course, I'm very interested in that. I mean, who's kidding whom? You know you're reading a book. And I think it's interesting to let that be part of the book, if it's applicable.
Sure.
Sometimes I've been very interested in that question. Other times, there's different kinds of stories I've written that it doesn't apply. It all depends. But in this latest book, for example, it is a book about emotional states, which are revealed often through the imaginary material August Brill, the narrator, main character, is telling. So it's complex, and we go into his mind as we're hearing the story he's making up.
Yeah.
It's not that he's just diverting us with a story. We're learning something about him through the story he's telling.
Yeah. I also will have to ask you, Vermont, again, we hit in this book. Vermont is there in the Book of Illusions. It's there in the Brooklyn Follies. What is your concern with Vermont here? I mean, are you a big maple syrup fan? What's the deal?
No. It's quite simple. For a long number of years, Siri and I and our kids went up to Vermont, and we lived there every summer for 3 months. We rented the same old beaten-up house on the top of a mountain. And so I would say I spent at least a year and a half, close to 2 years of my life in that house. I love it up there. It's a splendid place, especially in the summer. And I'm very attached to it, and it keeps coming back in the novels.
Have you thought to venture outside of Vermont a little bit more frequently? And then, of course, there's Virginia in this book, who is the one shared element between Brill and Brick. This leads me into a question about this delicate balance between the fictional construct in the book and the so-called real construct.
Well, Virginia,
in the book.
The person, not the state.
Of course, but
Virginia.
We're talking about states here, and it pops into my mind.
Yeah.
But this is the one carryover between the two worlds, and I wanted to ask you about this because this has been a common motif throughout your book, and yet I kept thinking at some point that Brick would somehow actually run into Brill, and yet this never happened. I'm wondering if you felt that perhaps going into such a hypothetical meeting...
Well, it's very simple. I mean, Brill later tells his granddaughter, Katya, that the first great love of his life at 15 was Virginia Blaine. And we know already that Virginia Blaine is a character in the story he's made up, but it's very simple. He's imagining his old flame as the character in the story he's making up.
Yeah.
I mean, writers do this all the time.
Yeah. But why that particular carryover? It almost implies that creation or memory, that relationship between the two of them, starts from adolescence or starts from some deep seed within any particular writer's mind.
Well, because Brick, too, fell for her when he was 15. And never could muster the courage to ask her out. And then she suddenly pops up in his life again, years later, 15 years later. So she has a particular hold over him. He's particularly drawn to her, attracted to her. And if it hadn't been Virginia Blaine, the girl from his past, he probably wouldn't have been so easily seduced.
Yeah. I also want to ask you about magic, and this is a kind of carryover between Brill and Brick, too. Owen Brick, of course, is a professional magician, and then later on in the book, when August is having this long 50-page dialogue with his granddaughter, he says of his relationship history, solid marriage in one box, lively mistress in another box, and I, the master magician, standing between them with the skill and cunning never to open both boxes at the same time. For several months, I managed to make it work, and I was no longer a mere magician. Now, I have a rather pedantic observation about this. You use the word magic and magician in this book, but never magical. It's almost as if these two characters can never use a modifier with which to describe this relationship, this magical relationship between fiction. And I'm wondering if this is in some way you're commenting upon the way in which a writer tells a story, whether it is something that he says to himself in a dark room or sets down upon paper.
No, again, I think this is parsing too finely. Brick is a magician, but of a lower order. I mean, he performs at children's birthday parties, old people's homes. And I don't know if you remember or if you read The Invention of Solitude, my first prose book. Well, I do talk about my maternal grandfather in that book at some length. And he was an amateur magician. And I grew up with his magic tricks. I became fascinated with this. And when he got old and was retired, he spent his days touring retirement homes and performing under the name of the Great Zavella, which I resurrected for this book.
Yes.
So Brick performs under that name, too.
Got it. Well, this is an interesting idea about writing as an act of confession. I mean, August cannot write his memoirs, but he also cannot write down this story that he's telling, in which this character is trapped in, essentially, only to cross over within a universe within a universe, so to speak. And I was wondering if this idea to impart information represented some idea of how one, I guess, memorializes memory. Is something like this what you had in mind with this? Or what was the scenario here as to why he can't actually write? And yet also he has this great archive of all of the reviews that he's done throughout the course of his life.
Well, he didn't make the archive. That was his daughter who did it as a birthday present for his 70th birthday. He's not interested in what he wrote particularly. And he goes at some length to explain that in the beginning. His daughter had asked him to write a memoir for the family, as many older people do, and he started, and then he got too depressed. His wife died, and he was thinking about all the rotten things he'd done in his life, and he just lost heart, and he gave up. And he says, I never had any interest in writing a book in my life. I like to read them and to write about them, but not to write books myself.
Another Oster book, another Hawthorne reference. Rose Hawthorne this time, his daughter, the source of Miriam's project. But this was interesting to me because it's almost as if it represents August's own inability to directly relate to his daughter. Because you're talking about a figure who is essentially expected to almost be a kind of apple that falls far from the tree, but then she goes on to care for cancer patients and she has a rather faltering literary ability. And I found this to be very interesting in light of the fact that August really goes to his granddaughter more than his daughter, particularly during the last portion of the book. And I'm wondering if this was, in a sense, a way of reflecting the trappings of culture.
No, you see, if you look very closely at the text, he says that, first of all, it's Miriam who invites him to live in the house. She says, I need you there. I don't want to be alone anymore. And then he says, you know, we were settling into a very nice routine before Katya had all her troubles. I think there's a great deal of closeness between them. And her birthday present, doing that website of his work, is an act of heroic patience and generosity, it seems to me. So I wouldn't say they have a troubled relationship. They have had one in the past. I think during the time of his divorce, when she was an adolescent, it was very difficult. But it seems to me that they've more or less patched things up. And after all, when morning does come and she walks into the room, the first thing she does is, you know, pat his cheek and give him a kiss. So I think they're pretty good together, those two.
But it's interesting that the text reflects more of a dialogue between his granddaughter as opposed to his daughter, which brings us back to the Rose Hawthorne question of essentially he's jumping one generation in an effort to reach out to
this region. Well, you see, too, Miriam is busy. She's teaching and she's writing, whereas Katya is just sitting there all day and Brill has nothing to do. So they're natural allies. They're the really wounded ones in the household.
Yeah.
And so they spend a lot of time together. Rose Hawthorne is a very interesting character and very moving. And I think what she did in the later part of her life is extraordinary, because at the time cancer was considered a communicable disease.
Yeah.
And so cancer patients were isolated. And she was the first one, at least in New York, to live with the patients, take care of them. And the hospice is still there. You know, it's on the Lower East Side. It's there, Rosary House.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole enclave up in, ironically enough, Hawthorne, New York, which was a more elaborate place that she set up and is still functioning. It's run by nuns.
I wanted to also ask you about the internet, because you have essentially been holding out on any direct reference to the internet, I've noticed, in the last few books. And in this one, all of a sudden, we do, in fact, see the internet presented. I wanted to ask you about this because it would seem to me a natural medium with which to explore the relationship between falsehood and truth. You know, well, so why did you hold off for so long?
Well, I tell you, there are two reasons. Because I don't have a computer, and I'm not on the internet, and I never do it. I never look, and I don't do emails. And I think it's a choice. I think that, first of all, I don't like typing on computers. I've tried it. I like my old typewriter better. And I don't want to be so available. I see all my friends and my dear wife bombarded with emails, overwhelmed. Everyone is dragging around this burden of guilt because they haven't answered the 6,000 unanswered letters. And I just thought, I don't want to go there. But I'm awake enough to know that it's part of the world now, so I'm perfectly happy to put it in a book. But I don't really want it myself.
Do you even use the internet in any sense?
Well, I do, in the sense that I have an assistant, a young woman who works for me. She comes in about once every week or two, and I give her my mail to answer, because it's really a flood and I can't take care of it all. Whenever there's an email address on the letter, she emails that person.
Yeah.
And so I am using email, but indirectly.
As you have your email surrogate.
Right, right.
I wanted to ask you about something that I've long been interested in your books, and that is your concern for specific dollar amounts. It again plays up here in the Pulaski Diner, where everything is $5. And I also think about the scenario with M.R. Chang in Oracle Knight, in which there's the whole situation between the $10 notebook and the $10,000 notebook, and it becomes completely ridiculously violent. But there is something about the propinquity of the dollar amount that you keep coming back to in your work. What is it about money, and what is it about a specific figure like this?
It's funny. I never thought about that. Money does. Well, listen, money is important. Everyone cares about money. And when you don't have money, money becomes the overriding obsession of your life. I mean, I wrote a whole book about that, hand to mouth. And the only good thing about making money is that you don't have to think about money.
Yeah,
I think it's the only value, because if you don't have it, you're crushed. And for a long period of my life, I was crushed. And so maybe this is a reflection of those tough years. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
Or maybe there is something absurd about a specific dollar amount for something. I mean, certainly when I go to a store and I see that something is set at a particular dollar amount or it fluctuates, it becomes a rather ridiculous scenario because all you want to do is get that particular object.
Yes, yes, yes. But often in my books, people don't have a lot of money in their pockets, so they have to budget themselves carefully.
Well, not always. You tend to have characters like, for example, in the Brooklyn Follies, people who have a good windfall to fall back on and who also offer frequently to help pay for things, and their efforts are often rejected out of pride by your supporting characters.
Yeah.
And so, I again, money is this interesting concern, but I mean, I'm wondering why you've held on to this notion for, you know, it's now 30 years since the events depicted in Hand to Mouth. I mean, is it just something you haven't forgotten about, or?
I guess I haven't forgotten about it.
Do you still pinch pennies to this day?
Or? No, not at all. No. I'm not a tightwad at all. I'm generous. I give good tips, and it's just the way I live my life, ironically enough, is I don't want anything. I'm not a consumer. I don't crave objects. I don't have a car. We don't have a country house. We don't have a boat. We don't have anything that lots of people have. And I'm not interested. I barely can go shopping for clothes. I find it difficult to walk into stores. The whole thing bores me so much. I guess the only thing I spend money on is cigars and food and alcohol. Those are the main expenses.
No, not books?
No, because, you know, our library in the house is so bursting, we have no more room. We have things on the floor all over the place, and books come into the house at the rate of, well, you see, three came today, for example. I'm pointing to them on the table here. So we're just inundated with books.
I have this problem myself. I'm wondering, do you read much contemporary fiction, or do you resort to the old library of trusted staples of books, great books that you need to get around to reading eventually?
Well, it's a bit of both. When I'm writing a novel myself, I don't read other fiction. I can't. I'm so locked into my own world. I don't want to hear anybody else's voice. So I tend to read nonfiction when I'm working. In between novels, that's when I catch up. And it's usually the same stable. I've got, I don't know, there are maybe 8 or 10 writers that I follow closely, and I want to know what they're doing. And so I read their books. And
who are those 8 or 10?
Well, DeLillo, Coetzee, Carey, Rushdie. Well, he's dead now, but I used to read everything that Kapuscinski published. I loved his work. Not a novelist, but a great writer. Rick Moody, I like his work a lot. So different people, and I don't have time until I'm finished with a book.
Do you find conversations with other people to be intrusive to the writing process? Are you one of those types who really needs total silence in order to concentrate on what you're doing? It sounds to me like you're an easily distracted person, what with the unplugging of the internet or the resistance to the internet and also not writing.
No, I'm not so distractible. The way I work is, as you can see, we live in this big brownstone in Brooklyn, but I don't work here. I have a little apartment in the neighborhood that I go to, and there's nothing to do there but work. It's a very simple place. And very few people have the phone number, so I know when the phone rings, it's bound to be something important. And except when it's one of those electronic messages trying to sell you car insurance, but then you hang up.
You have a cell phone? Or?
No, I don't have a cell phone either. And so I'm not distractible. The quiet of that place is great for the work, great for thinking.
Going back to Man in the Dark, there is one thing I wanted to mention, and that was going back to the diner. Brick and Molly have a scenario in which their relationship is based again around money. And this reminded me very much of Marina in the Brooklyn Follies. It's almost the exact same motivations in both situations, except with the way it plays out, the juxtaposition and the rhythm of the particular moment in conjunction with all the other ones. And I wanted to ask you about this because I'm wondering if something that may be trope-like for you is a way of placing it into another particular rhythm with which to create additional momentum that you hadn't anticipated.
Well, the circumstances are so different between Glass and Brick. Nathan is 60 years old. He's retired. Cancer in remission, and he has nothing to do. He has a lot of time on his hands, and he goes to this diner in Brooklyn and gets a little crush on one of the waitresses. Mm-hmm. Whereas Brick is in desperate straits, in a state of total confusion, and he needs to eat. He walks into this diner and he meets this girl who happens to be the waitress. But their relationship is very different from the other.
Yeah, but it could almost, there are a lot of parallels in terms of how the situation is set up, and I'm wondering if you consider recycling particular situations and placing them in completely different contexts in a way to see another side of something, some standard situation, like sitting down in the diner or a man having feelings for a waitress, that allows you to find an additional way of perceiving life or perceiving life and capturing it, this representation within text?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Brick has no sexual attraction to Molly. Yeah. She's the first person he meets. He's the one who he hopes will help him. No, I wasn't consciously trying to echo the previous customer-waitress relationship. I'm trying to think if there are any other cases. I don't think there are any other waitresses in my books, but...
Yeah, just recently I've noticed. There's more diners, actually, in your more recent books than your previous ones. Are you a diner man? Is that the situation?
Not really. Once in a while I go and, you know, have a hamburger or a cheese sandwich or something, but that's it.
There is one other thing I have to ask you about, and that is the summary of a book or a particular film. We see in this particular book, Katya and August, as we were talking about earlier, sitting in the dark, basically binging on movies. And Katya explains this interesting theory about objects revealing how people relate to each other in these great films that they watch.
Yeah.
And this made me think about why you have summaries so frequently in your work, and I'm wondering if why you're so fond of them. Is this a way for you to express the idea of, okay, well, I can tell a lot about a person with how they state or put into stone something that we all know about, like, you know, the plot line for Out of the Past or whatnot? Why the constant summaries in your book? Is it more of a relationship between fiction and reality, or is it more of this idea of how one conveys something is contingent upon who they are and what
no,
they are.
I think it's this. Most novels do not include other novels in them, and most novels don't deal with artworks of any kind. But to me, books and films and paintings are part of our lives, and why not bring them into fictions? Why not let them be part of the story? And then sometimes, if you do it right, I mean, it can be a kind of parable within the larger story that will teach you something about the novel you're reading at the same time.
Yeah.
In the case of Man in the Dark, I think those three films that they discuss very early in the book, and they are Grand Illusion, The Bicycle Thief, and The World of Apu. Each one of those stories, particularly the moments in those stories they're discussing, are very intimate, about relationships between men and women, husbands and wives. And I think what's happening there in terms of the structure of the novel is the groundwork is being laid for what's going to happen later.
Yeah.
Because this book takes a sharp turn, as you indicated, and later on, the long conversation between August and Katya is about family, is about her grandmother, his wife. And then in the middle of the book, too, he stops and thinks of another film that embodies her idea about objects as a way of expressing human emotions in cinema, and that's Tokyo Story, the Ozu film, the watch at the end of, at the end of the film.
Paul, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks.
You're very welcome.